This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
Hey, thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. This is Katie, HRN Executive Director, and I'm so excited to share with you our coverage from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival.
We are here live today at Charleston Wine and Food.
Join us as we talk all things food.
Come to Charleston, eat some seafood. Eat all of the seafood.
Chicken fried chicken with chorizo steak and salsa verde mashed potatoes.
So quintessentially like Southern fare at its finest.
And have important conversations.
We're also talking about professional women in restaurants and how underrepresented they are, people of color in restaurants, and how they're not talked about.
We get real with Food Network's Manit Chauhan.
Balance is BS. I was told that I wasn't going to be bleeped out.
And find out about raising sugarcane with Chef Sean Brock.
It's like being Indiana Jones or something. You never know what you're going to find.
You'll come away inspired by the power of food and the food scene in Charleston. Here's Dr. Jessica B. Harris.
Food is constantly in flux. Food is always moving. Food is the only real lingua franca that we have that allows us to connect with other folks.
So tune in to Heritage Radio Network on tour at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can't go wrong.
Welcome to HRN Happy Hour. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, and somewhere is Bushwick. I'm Kat Johnson, the Communications Director here at Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with my co-host, Katie Mosman-Wadler, the Executive Director.
Hey, Kat.
Hello.
Happy to be back Thursday afternoon, as always.
Back in action.
Back in action. We've also got the rest of the HRN team in the studio with us today. Our guest hosts are Hannah Forden and Sarah Strong. Hey, guys.
Happy Thursday.
Hi.
And in the booth, as always, our stalwart engineer, Dave Tadashore, making us sound great.
That's me.
Hey, Dave.
And I'm really excited about the guests that we have here in the studio with us today. First, I'd like to introduce a really good friend of mine, Esther Trukinski. Hi, Esther.
Hey, Katie. How are you?
I'm so happy to be sitting next to you in here. Esther is a lawyer who changed her focus to food studies and is now teaching food policy and politics and also food systems in the food studies program at NYU Steinhardt. And she's currently the farm-to-school coordinator for New York City's Department of Education, where she's working to design and develop a supply chain to bring food grown and produced in New York State into the city's public schools. And also, she is an advisor to a variety of startups and nonprofits in the food space, including Heritage Radio Network. So we're so grateful to you.
Thanks, Esther.
Oh, wow. It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
Our other guests today are a really, really dynamic team of people who are making some very delicious drinks. Darren Grenia, Julian Muhammad, and Roxanne Maliki. They're the team behind Wandering Barman, which delivers handcrafted cocktails in a bottle, and you can find them around Bushwick and surrounding neighborhoods. Welcome, guys.
How you doing?
Hello.
Hi. All right, so we're super excited to crack open some drinks, talk to everybody a little bit later, but first we're going to jump into our headlines.
So this week, Buen Limon Radio hit the road and took us with them on a culinary adventure through Hong Kong, where they explored street food, tea houses, elegant hotel restaurants and markets, and host Diego Senor also interviews Irvine Welsh about his latest book, T2, Trainspotting.
And on Cutting the Curd, they launched their Women in Cheese series this week, kicking off with guest Tess McNamara. She's the director of retail and operations at Lucy's Way. Tess chatted with Cutting the Curd's new producer, Elena Santagade, about the specific challenges of navigating a career in cheese as a woman.
And on Speaking Broadly, Dana welcomed her guest, Taylor Lanzett, who is also the former producer of Eating Matters here on Heritage Radio Network. So shout out to her. Taylor is a queer advocate for food system change and inclusivity. She began her career by creating a CSA-style program in college for students, faculty, and low-income customers, and now sources millions of pounds of produce as the director of supply and sustainability for the Dig In Restaurant Group.
Beer Sessions Radio featured a tasting this week hosted by Chad Jacob Santo, founder of Crooked Stave. Host Jimmy Carboni chatted with Chad at length about sours, Brett, and wild ale beers,
So beer nerds, take note. And this week on the food scene, they had guest Margaret Palka of the Carroll Garden staple, Margaret Palka Bakes. Margaret shared her story of how an apprenticeship in France in French pastry took her from aspirations in the art of the world to the streets of Paris and her dream of owning her own bakery.
Best arugula in New York.
That's what I heard.
Period.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a big claim.
The picture looked awesome.
Try me.
Oh. Wow. That was aggressive.
Yep.
So these are just a few of the interviews that you can listen to on Heritage Radio Network that were recorded this week. There's so many more, so make sure you go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Browse around, see what interests you. You can also subscribe to all of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, iHeartRadio. There's lots more wherever you get your podcasts.
So now I'd just like to give a quick shout out to a couple of events. This one is a big tip of our collective radio hats to former HRN Executive Director Aaron Fairbanks. So Aaron is blowing up the Ladies Night event series. If you haven't already RSVP'd to tonight's snow date version of the Ladies Night at Saxilby Cheesemongers, then you might be out of luck because I think that it's full for tonight. But I have great news for you, which is that on Wednesday, April 18th, is the official April Ladies Night, which is being co-hosted by Bento Box and League of Kitchens. This is going to be held at the Bento Box headquarters in Soho. The lineup includes Bento Box co-founder and CEO Crystal Mobayeni, League of Kitchens founder and CEO Lisa Gross, cooking instructor Yamini Joshi, and Bento Box marketing coordinator Christina Martin. So get your tickets now to join these entrepreneurial women for an evening of drinks, snacks, and inspiring conversations. You can go to bekindbefierce.com or on Eventbrite. I believe you can search for Ladies Night there and just make sure that you RSVP. This is really not to be missed if you're a woman in the food space. Anyone who identifies as female is welcome.
Aaron Fairbank.
Hey, Aaron.
That's Aaron.
We should also give a shout out event-wise that not this Saturday, but next, April 14th, is Cherry Bomb Jubilee. So, ladies in the food world, there's a lot of stuff coming your way. So make sure you check out that as well.
Get those tickets. And I believe that one is open to people who also identify as other than female. Just make sure you get your tickets because that will definitely sell out.
Yeah, there's some really good speakers at Jubilee this year. Nigella Lawson, Ruth Rogers, Priya Krishna, lots more that I'm blanking on.
I'm excited to hear from Jane's Beard again.
Jane's
I love those
Beard. Of course, Carrie Diamond, our own Carrie Diamond.
And Simon Nosrat.
Yes. Yeah. Who is sweeping all the awards this year with her amazing book, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. If you don't have that cookbook, you need to get that cookbook. It will teach you how to cook.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And all of her awesome New York Times cooking articles are super great, too. You turned me on to those, Kat.
Yes.
So go to cherrybomb.com and get those tickets. So I just want to say thank you, everyone who's in the studio with us once again, for joining. And as you know, this is sort of a free-form variety show kind of format. So we're going to jump in. We have some interview questions for Wandering Barman and for Esther. And also feel free to ask each other questions if anything comes up in the conversations. Esther, I want to start out with you and talk about a little bit of what kind of drove your transition from 20 years of working in law as a lawyer to deciding to get your master's in food policy and start teaching. So tell us a little bit about that career path.
I'm kind of grinning at that question. The way I've characterized it over the last bunch of years since the transition started was my life was thrown into a martini shaker in 2008-2009 apropos of the barman, yeah. The traveling barman. I really did use that metaphor, even though I do not drink martinis, just to be clear. My father became terminally ill. I was at that time in my own law practice, and the bulk of my work was on two sets of what we call bet the company cases in the trademark space. And each of the sets were multiple litigations with multiple parties about trademark issues. Dad became sick. He became combative because dementia was setting in. My dad, the Holocaust survivor, had a lot of ghosts that were coming up. And my sisters and I, frankly, couldn't afford to pay four aides around the clock. So it became three aides and me. Of the three daughters, I was the only one in a position to actually step in and do that. So I basically suspended my practice. All the parties were kind of ready for adjournments. The courts involved were more than happy to allow the parties to adjourn everything indefinitely. Took care of Dad. Dad died in January of 2009. I, at the same time, was transitioning and moved up to Westchester with my partner, Stuart, and his children, or at least the ones that were still not in college. And I moved up to Scarsdale. And by the time I resurrected my practice in the spring, parties were ready to settle. I settled everything favorably, yada, 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 and was not able to, in part because my heart wasn't necessarily in it, but to resurrect a solo practice up in Westchester. Fast forward a few years later, I had enough of Westchester. I went in 2013 to spend full time living in our country house up in Columbia County. And by then I had become very focused, fixated, enamored, I don't know what the right word is, of the food world. More food, cooking, restaurants, writing, teaching. And I had come across some mention of the food studies program, and I was like, wow, I want to do that. And so when Stuart and I were kind of redesigning our life, I was complaining that I was sort of rudderless for the first time in my adult life, and he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to go back to school and get that degree. He said, okay, then I'll support you in that. And September 2013, I started at NYU with a view towards teaching and writing cookbooks for kids. And people like Marion Nessel and my systems professor, Carolyn Dimitri, basically wouldn't let me leave the law. And they said, no, you know, we're not giving you up. And here I am.
And Esther, because we graduated together, we spent a lot of time working on our collective theses. Talk about your project for your grad studies thesis.
I will try to be brief. The lawyer in me, I'm a litigator, or always have been, and I saw a need for training of lawyers and food policy advocates jointly. You can't make anything happen. You can't promote change. You can't effectuate change unless you know how to work the legal system, because so much of what's broken is policy, which is law. So I envision a clinical program that would bridge the gap between a law school and a policy, graduate policy school, which a model which does not exist, and created a model for a training program, experiential learning program, to bring law students and policy students together to work on real matters in the food world. And I talk about in my project a particular litigation plan that I think, and I still think, would move the needle on the problem of advertising food to kids. It takes it away from the argument that the First Amendment protects it absolutely.
And I want to talk more about your teaching at NYU, but I just want to jump over. And can you tell us briefly what you're doing as the Farm to School Coordinator with New York City?
I am working with a group of really dedicated people. I mean, I think that what I came to learn almost immediately when I was brought into school food, and I was brought in by another classmate of ours, George Edwards, who's been working at the DOE for quite a long time. He heads up the Garden to Cafe program, which is a program, educational program, that introduces kids in the schools to fruits and vegetables. And he's a really terrific chef, and he creates recipes. And there's another chef, Holly, who does the same thing. And they go in and they teach these kids to schools. George and some of his colleagues wrote a grant from New York State to bring in a farm to school coordinator to try and increase the amount of local food that's brought into the school system. As you probably know, and I'm sure people listening know, New York City public schools is the largest school system in the country. The statistic I've heard is that we are the largest purchaser of food in the country, second only to the Department of Defense. And I personally don't think that it's crazy. I don't think the Department of Defense is a fair comparison, because as I understand it, and somebody may correct me out there, the Department of Defense number includes the meals they serve overseas. So to my mind, we are the largest food service operation in the country. As such, we are the largest purchaser. But we don't have a good enough local program because of the way we're set up. We have five distributors for five districts. because the overwhelming challenge is to actually get the food into the schools to these kids, and that is the priority. The menu management department that designs the menus is really, really committed to creating the most healthy meals they can, given the parameters of what our supply chain permits. So the vision is for me, along with George and the other people in the department, to come up with a way of introducing our distributors to a bigger, more reliable supply of local food. Local being New York is really, I'm focusing on the Bronx because that's where the highest need is for healthier food because of the health outcomes in the Bronx at the lowest in the city.
So a pretty major project and also super policy related still. It seems like you you are not getting away from that ever, I don't think.
I don't think so.
It's just not going to happen. Okay, so I was super lucky to get to visit your class last week with Katie Kiefer and experience what a session of your food policy class is like.
That was actually food systems.
Sorry, food systems. To me, it's all food policy.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So talk about what are some of the issues that you're covering right now and what are the issues that are the most exciting for students in your class. And maybe just like for background, who like describe, you know, the typical student or like the types of students that you have in that class.
In this semester in food systems, it's an undergraduate class. And I think there's a fairly even split between students who are either in food studies or global public health who have some grounding in the subject matter and some pre-existing opinions and views. And then I have students from all across the university. I have an engineer, I have a biology major, I have a computer science major, I have a business major. And they are uniformly concerned about the environment and climate change. They are uniformly concerned about the effect of trade on the food system. You know, the looming trade war, if I can say that, concerns them in the sense that farmers are going to get nailed, and it's become pretty clear from the reporting that it's an intentional target. Farmers are an intentional target to create leverage on the administration, which is pretty freaking clever, if you ask me. They are concerned about food security. They are very much bewildered by the fact that we produce so much food and that so many people are still hungry and don't have access to it. Food deserts, you know, the things that you would expect young, hopefully budding advocates to care about.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about the trade situation right now, and it's like, it's crazy to think about what's going to happen.
Yeah, I was I co-teach with Marion Nessel her food policy and politics, which basically means I'm her backup. And we had class last night, and that was the first thing that the students brought up. That's a graduate school. There's 72 in there, so that's a broad spectrum of interests from both nutrition and global public health. And that was a huge, huge topic last night.
Do you mind if I ask how it's actually going to affect the farming industry, like exactly?
It's all over the papers the last couple of days. One of the things the Chinese have done is issue a list of, I think it's 128 products that they're going to tax, put tariffs on, and there's farm produce all over. So okay. Soy, corn, and pork particularly are going to be hit with what they're threatening to be 25% tariffs.
So that goes from here to there? I didn't realize
Anything. So Trump announced a tariff on anything coming from them to us in steel and aluminum, so they're retaliating by saying, okay, tit for tat, and apparently it's being actually referred to as the tit for tat tax.
Yeah, and the major states where, like, pork and soybeans and corn comes from are, like, Iowa, Illinois. It's, like, Trump's base is.
Yep. Right.
So they're they're specifically targeting those.
I just didn't realize China was importing.
They import a lot of soybeans, especially.
I think they're our largest customer. Mm-hmm. Today on the Daily, the New York Times has this podcast series, and
so good.
It's so good. And today they interviewed Michael
Barbaro.
He interviewed a corn and soy and pork farmer from the middle of the country who is he characterizes himself as a staunch Republican. He supported Trump. He voted for Trump. If he knew then what he knew, then today he would still vote for Trump, but he's very concerned. He estimated that this tariff could hit his business to the tune of 30% reduction.
Wow.
And right? He does not make a 30% profit on anything.
Wow. Well, this is heavy stuff, guys.
And the good news is he seems to be backing off of it now.
Right.
Now, you know, now they're trying to characterize it as a ploy to open up trade talks. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fine. That's his whole plan. His plan all along. Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, you know what?
Master negotiator.
When there's not much we can do, well, we can drink, right?
Right.
Right, guys?
Okay.
That's my transition.
We will not tax you on what we have.
You saw me voting and drinking. Beautiful bottles.
Yes. So I want to ask Roxanne, Julian, and Darren, I kind of want to hear the origin story of Wandering Barman. Julian and Darren, you guys co-own Yours Sincerely, where you serve cocktails on tap.
Yes.
And you've described this as kind of a proof of concept for the pre-batch cocktails that Wandering Barman is, you know, selling. So what was the bottled cocktails part of the plan all along, or was it an idea that you kind of got along the way?
Kind of, a bit of both, really. We had a restaurant to begin with called Dear Bushwick, which was already in Bushwick. We had issues with, maintaining and speed of service of a regular cocktail program over there. Like, people would get their appetizers before they got their cocktails. And we had the space next door. We were going to open a bar there. And we wanted to open a cocktail bar, but we didn't want people to wait 15 minutes for their drinks. So we were like, okay, let's try and do draft cocktails. We figured out how to make that good. It took us 2 years of R&D. And I think we kind of proved the success. And in the back of our heads, it was like bottled cocktails or more of these bars. And we kind of realized that we would prefer to basically bottle cocktails and put them in everyone else's bars so we don't have to basically run bars.
And the main idea for the bar was sort of a solution to problems that we were having in the restaurant when we were dealing with a 12 to 14 craft cocktail menu with, you know, 5 to 8 ingredients in each, and the timing that it takes to make that to order. And, you know, it was always a battle of trying to beat the appetizers to the table and that kind of thing with the drinks. So it really was a solution-based idea, you know, to kind of bring that to the next level.
Right. So there's a few cocktails being passed around, and they're incredibly beautiful, and the labels are incredibly beautiful. Can you describe what we're about to drink and maybe identify them by the color so we know which is which?
So the, the brown one is the old-fashioned. That's a date bourbon. It's a date-infused bourbon old-fashioned with aromatic orange bitters that we make in-house, everything we make in-house. The red one is the Miss Casanova, that is spicy daiquiri. It's hibiscus-infused rum, chipotle, orange, and lime.
I just tried this one, and it's so incredibly awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love this.
The Miss Casanova there.
Oh, my God.
The orangish-yellowish one, that's a new one that we're coming to market in probably about a month and a half, 2 months. That is Hatch green chili vodka from New Mexico. The chilies are from New Mexico. We make the vodka, but Hatch green chili, pineapple, turmeric, and then the clearer one is our gin old fashioned. It's gin, cucumber, elderflower, lemon, celery, bitters.
Did you just say you make your own vodka?
We do the infusion.
Oh, okay. I was like, excuse me.
Wandering Distillery and Barman.
Maybe one day.
Roxanne, how did you get involved with these guys?
Good question. Ask myself that every day. I came from the fashion industry. I was a product development manager. Try to work in that industry for a while, and then got sick of the bullshit, if I'm allowed to say that.
You are. It's internet, radio.
And I grew up in the service industry. My parents had restaurants. Ended up being a busser for those guys at Dear Bushwick when they were opening Yours Sincerely. And looking at the cocktail bar, we were brainstorming and ended up managing the two spots with them. And we really saw potential to solve a bigger issue instead of opening a bunch of bars, like the guys were saying. We were envisioning really helping other bar managers and bar owners being more profitable, more efficient, and also kind of cutting the crap and calling craft cocktails not pretentious and mm-hmm. fun and colorful. And you could drink one in a dive bar or a music venue or anywhere you want, and it could still be quality. And that idea was just brilliant to me.
I agree. I mean, it's really nice if you want to go to a dive bar, and sometimes you do want to go to a dive bar and you want to have a cheap beer, and that's great. And sometimes I want to go to a dive bar and have the same vibe, but I want to, like, drink something really tasty.
Yeah, or if you're in a sports bar, I mean, I don't watch sports or drink beer, and it's always a miserable time, but I still have to be with my friends. I can at least have an old-fashioned, a decent old-fashioned, and recognize the brand and know I'll like it, you know?
Well, I have to say that we're on radio, so nobody out there can see this, but I'm looking at these beautiful labels, and they are a lot of things, but dive bar is not one of them.
Good.
They are beautiful and elegant. They're all women.
Thank you.
They're gorgeous. I mean, and the as I we were talking about before we went on the air, the color of the drink flows from the color of the label, or I should say vice versa. They're just beautiful, but they're all women. So.
Well, actually, one of them is me.
Really?
It is a pink label. But,
okay.
Make sure we put him in pink, though.
You're in pink, and I
I'm
can't see without my
Keeping
glasses.
Keeping it real.
Okay.
Yeah, what's the inspiration behind the labels?
Having fun and... just being colorful and artistic and having fun, and you know, really we wanted to take pretension out of the game, and I think partially it's some of our personalities coming out and just being different and being noticeable on the back bar. And one of the things that they can also do, I know we're talking about dive bars and venues and stuff like that, but the other thing that we can do and are doing in some of the locations that we're in is complement and add an experience to an already existing cocktail menu. We're not there to take, you know, over by any means. We're just there to take part and to complement and add another experience, served from the bottle and you get the added bonus of, if you want, you can keep it.
And the idea, just to tag on to that, was that anyone could be the wandering barman. So the faces are hidden. You have, you know, the flowers coming out. One is an orange. It's just like... It doesn't have to be about the person so much. It's more about the quality of the product. So all of a sudden, the shift is, what am I drinking? This is great. Instead of, you know, feeling intimidated by someone behind the bar that might give you a bit of a
attitude.
And tell us where we can find Wandering Barman cocktails. And I would also like to know, of those places, kind of the response that you've gotten from bartenders and managers. Like, is it... How have they explained that's made their life easier, or how have the customers reacted?
It's interesting, actually. The first few spots we got into were in Bushwick, and we're in here, and it was people that we knew because we've been in the neighborhood for a while, and I think they thought that they were taking the product on as a favor, which we were grateful for. But the minute, like within 24 hours, they were reordering because the customers just loved them, and the bartenders were happy to just shake these things in the bottle and pour them over ice rather than taking a couple minutes to make a cocktail from scratch or made to order cocktail. And that's really what it comes down to. For some people, it's just like hassle free. For other, Le Garage, like restaurants, it's a matter of just easing the pressure on a busy Friday and Saturday night with all those made to order cocktails. They can slip a couple of bottle cocktails in there. And there's been no pushback whatsoever from customers. Like, the quality of our cocktails are at least as good as made to order, just from the precision that we can attain.
And so we're in restaurants like Le Garage, which is French Spot, Sally Roots. Then we're in bars like Diver Bars, like Three Diamond Door, Darlings. We're also at the Tiki Bar here at Roberta's. And then we're in music venues and clubs like House of Yes, Elsewhere, Union Pool in Williamsburg now. So we're really trying to be super diverse in where we're at. We're at Archie's.
Yeah, it really beats a Jell-O shot for a music venue. You're also naming like all the places that I go.
Yeah. This is good. This is good. Okay, so I as the resident nerd, are there technical challenges that you've had to conquer about bottling cocktails and about like shelf stability? I know that, you know, citrus flavors are really hard to hold on to over time. Are there any tricks you can share as far as kind of stabilizing some of these super, super fresh flavors, because these taste incredibly fresh?
One of the main thing that we learned and had to figure out opening the bar, because we are draft only, is preservation of cocktails. So we've kind of, that's sort of been or become like our backbone, and what we are known for and what we are good at is making things last. So we kicked fresh juice to the curb, except for actually in the Miss Casanova, we use fresh cucumber juice. But for the most part, when you're talking for acids, citrus acids and such, we graduated into, and a lot of bars and cocktail spots are experimenting with it now, with acids, citric acid, malic acid, things like that. So we do a proprietary blend of acid solution, and you know, creates sort of like a blank palate sour, and then you can kind of take that into a direction. It really adds, it gives you like a bag of tricks, kind of. You can, it doesn't have to taste like lime if you don't want to.
It's all natural.
Yeah, or food derived, yeah. FYI. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. I love cocktails that are made of food.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, citric and malic, most people have heard of those before. Citric coming from citrus fruits and malic, most notably from apples. So all naturally occurring organic compounds.
Do either of you have a food science background or a technical background?
Well, I think Darren's definitely developed a quite significant
just reading
technical
no formal education other than you know, being extremely interested in what I'm doing and you know, reading books and learning.
I'd be surprised if anyone knows more than Darren about this.
Books work for
as
me.
As far as cocktails. I mean,
obviously, if you go to school and you're something, you know, you're good at it or you're interested in it, it comes easy. And this is something that I've been interested in for a long time. And
great.
This isn't something we just put together overnight. You know, the R&D for this was a couple years in the making. And
it's obvious. They're beautiful and they smell wonderful and they taste amazing. And so,
and you can attain the relevant citrus flavor by using the citrus oils. So as far as that goes, we're kind of like just taking away the juice part of say a lime, and we're keeping the acid and the oils.
Sort of removing anything that would be perishable.
Yeah. Right. And that's the aromas come from the oils.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is retail in your future? Because I did notice that these are sub 4 ounce airplane friendly bottles.
If there are any airlines listening, we are in the market. Or
we do not discriminate.
Yeah,
that's
we are in as far as retail right now. We are in two liquor stores.
Irving Bottle. Shout out to Irving Bottle. Shout one of our business members.
Woo! Yep, and Blue Angel in Williamsburg.
Nice.
But the idea is really to try to bring a solution to, like we were saying, bartenders and bar managers. So we were especially aiming towards those venues. We believe that, you know, you need to understand the product and recognize the product before you're going to pick it up on a shelf. Not everyone's as good as a store like Irving Bottle is going to explain and understand what they have. So having bartenders that love our product is like having brand ambassadors. You know, we just have people pouring it. They're excited about it. It's like them, if they're pouring a good scotch or a good glass of wine or a beer they love, we want them to feel the same way and feel like they're part of the community.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you, before we go to break really quick, what's next?
The moon.
The world. World takeover.
We all kinds of things, packaging for certain situations. We're looking at different types of cocktails, say carbonated. We definitely have a long term. Actually, how much can I reveal right now? Not too much.
All of it.
Festival packaging, you know, things like that for mass use.
Yeah.
We have a lot of collaborations in our heads. So we're looking to, you know, we it's a sustainable product. It's less wasteful than anything else. We waste less water. We don't less, you know, everything's weighed to the point gram. So we're super careful in that. And so we want to collaborate with cool brands. And coming from the fashion industry and all being pretty creative, we want to partner in different ways that maybe liquor brands don't always do.
Cool.
To be continued.
That like leaves me wanting so much more from Wandering Barman. Okay, we're going to take a really quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to play our infamous round of trivia.
Great.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Thank you, Roberta's.
Surf on over, dude.
Shout out to Brandon Hoy, who we saw in a documentary last night.
Yeah, we did.
That was kind of weird.
He didn't say anything.
Hey, he was just in it.
Yeah, just lurking around.
It's a Rolling Stone documentary about DIY venues in New York City, and we were just like 3/4 into it, and it's like, is that Brandon?
Yeah, that's just like Brandon sitting in a city council hearing, like, ready to throw down in his white hoodie also. Like,
I thought it looked like he had a white collared shirt on.
He was.
Oh,
he
really?
Was, yeah. Like a hoodie. Your
brain is just substituting the hoodie.
Outside of a hoodie. But yeah, he was really badass because he was super involved with the whole repeal of the cabaret law and the nightmare. We were there supporting our friend Raphael.
Raph!
We love you.
It
was cool.
Yes, that was a really fun event. I feel like I need to get know more about music venues in my neighborhood because I'm lame and don't do anything.
Yep.
At night after 10.
You shout out educated little
after 10.
Yeah, I'm like,
how about after 8?
Yeah. Now you're talking.
I'm the old person in the room, so it's okay.
Yeah, we should shout out because I actually live right across the street from it. There's a venue called Silent Barn that was featured in the documentary as well, and it's a DIY music venue. And they unfortunately are having to shutter because they are not able to like crowdsource enough money to stay open. However, they've become home to a small organization called Educated Little Monsters that's providing a creative outlet and community center space for youths in the Bushwick neighborhood, and they're trying to, you know, create a place for them to go. And they had someone there who was rapping, and it was really, really inspiring. And they're also going to have I'll announce this in a couple weeks when I have the exact dates, but they're going to be doing a silent auction to help raise money to keep that space going for Educated Little Monsters, I believe on April 20th.
Silent auction for Silent Barn. You can't forget that.
Yes. Silent auction at Silent Barn for Educated Little Monsters.
Yep.
Yeah, get it right.
Yeah. Cool. So we are back with our guests, Esther Trakinski and Darren Grinia, Julian Muhammad, Roxanne Maliki from Wandering Barman. And it's the time of the show where we play trivia.
Yikes.
I don't know that we warned everyone, but, you know, it's more fun that way.
Surprise!
All right, so I will read some trivia.
You can't phone a friend.
Yeah, this isn't like bar trivia. You can't cheat. It's too fast-paced for that.
If it's like bar trivia, then we can't win. Hannah's not wearing headphones.
Oh, David said if it's not bar trivia because we can't win.
No, I said it. Never mind. You messed it up.
He said, never mind, I messed it up.
You messed it up.
Totally win. All you win is our respect.
I said, if it was bar trivia, we couldn't win. Because we can't at bar trivia,
got it.
Apparently.
We all suck at trivia. We get it.
We get it. Okay, so today is National Tell a Lie Day. So I'm ready to tell you some facts, and you tell me if I'm telling the truth or lying. It's 50-50. How hard could it be?
Lying.
You win.
All right. Question number one.
Liar, liar, liar.
The name Pez comes from the French word for peppermint.
False.
Come on. We have a French person here, Roxanne.
Oh, no.
It's a lie.
That's a lie.
Yes, correct. It's a lie. There it is. It actually comes from the German word for peppermint, which is Pfefferminz. Taking the P from the first letter, E from the middle somewhere, and Z from the last letter to form the word Pez. Huh. Germans make everything more complicated. All right, number two. Mr. Rogers always mentioned out loud that he was feeding his fish because a young blind viewer once asked him to do so. She wanted to know the fish were okay.
On it.
We have a fan in
a
the
confident,
room.
You should add like an and something totally ridiculous.
A confident true. It was. It is true.
He's
is
a mind
true.
Reader.
And there's a new documentary coming out about him.
Yeah, I want to see that.
It looks really good. However, we had a discussion the other day. Hannah is very freaked out by Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't me. That was it was Margaret.
Margaret's freaked out by Mr. Rogers.
And I was passing the buck.
Were you a little bit freaked out by him? It was there were like two people in our office.
I grew up without television, so I was from the South Shore or something. But I have to just shout out that I know Francois Clemens, who was the police officer on Mr. Rogers. And he's an artist in residence at Middlebury in Vermont, David. It's Middlebury College is in Vermont, in case you weren't sure. But Francois is an artist in residence. He's an opera singer. He wears incredible, bedazzled caftans and jackets and like smoking jackets everywhere. We should probably buy Francois a dog moo-moo because that's the thing, apparently. But I don't know Mr. Rogers, but I know.
I mean, I love a man in a cardigan.
He'll love a bedazzled cardigan even more.
Yikes. Noted. Hannah is pro-cardigan. Margaret is anti-cardigan. Okay, question number three. During Prohibition, moonshiners would wear cow shoes. The fancy footwear left hoof prints instead of shoe prints, helping distillers and smugglers evade the police.
True.
Correct.
You're welcome.
It's a really good idea.
Thank you.
You
got that from a book, right?
I actually just guessed on that one, but it makes sense.
It's plausible.
Yeah, absolutely. Moonshine
people have done weirder things.
Right here in this room.
Yeah, I know. Number four, in 1887, Indiana state legislators outlawed selling prime rib on Sundays. That's it. There's no period in this. In 1887, Indiana state legislators outlawed selling prime rib on Sundays.
That sounds plausible.
I'm going to
say true as well.
Wait, it's Indiana,
blue
so
laws.
Yeah, anything's
possible. I thought you possible. Couldn't sell anything on Sundays.
So we're going with true.
True?
False.
Well, you're just saying that. He's like just looking at his
phone. I think it's too crazy to be false. It's got to be true.
Final answer.
It is false.
Yes.
No, we're 100%.
Do you blue laws in Indiana do prevent you from buying or selling something, but it's not prime rib. Anybody
liquor.
Have a guess?
Alcohol. Bacon.
No.
Oh, candy.
Think of like
cigarettes.
Drugs.
Blue laws, blue book.
Cocaine.
Cars.
The Bible?
Cars.
Cars?
What?
You can't buy cars on Sunday?
This was in 1887. I'm sure it's repealed now.
Did they have cars?
There were cars in 1887?
1887?
Apparently.
Ford. This is wrong.
I guess.
This is all a lie. Okay, number five.
We all have homework to do. That's all I can say.
Oh, gosh.
This machinery. Is Tell a Lie Day Inception. All trivia is a lie.
Number five. The 100 folds in a chef's toque are said to represent 100 ways to cook an egg.
This is nonsense.
We have someone saying adamantly yes.
I would say yes as well.
It's true.
The French woman says yes. We go with that.
We go with that. Okay, number six. Guinness estimates that 93,000 liters of beer are lost in facial hair each year in the UK alone.
Ew.
I'm gagging true. A little bit right now.
Lies.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
I don't understand.
I did the Guinness tour 2 years ago. Poured a perfect beer, I might say.
Nice.
And they didn't mention that, so I'm going to have to say it's false.
So they're saying it's lost in the
beard?
In the beard,
like food waste because sloppy. It gets like.
Yeah, but I think it's in my
head. Speak from experience that this is true. And if they say it's false, they're lying.
See, I lick it. I lick it out of my beard.
But that's way more than we need to know.
That's the demon's share.
The devil's cut.
I will say that the person with the biggest beard here is right. It's true.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. He has the biggest beard? Really?
I think so.
You just created a huge beard.
I would imagine that egg yolk is probably a close second.
Oh, no. Next question, please.
But wait, but I feel like my beard is just like curly.
We'll have that contest later.
Yeah, we'll short and curly.
All right, number seven. Reed Hastings. Do you guys know who Reed Hastings is?
No,
he's a jazz musician.
Good guess.
It's a brand of Reed.
He's the founder of Netflix, and he has said that he was inspired to start Netflix after a $100 late fee on a VHS of the... Okay, these questions
Rochelle,
are hard
Rochelle.
To read. He said that he was inspired to start Netflix after he got a $100 late fee on a VHS tape of The Cutting Edge.
That seems too obvious.
True.
I have no opinion. I've been wrong too many times.
It is false.
I knew it.
It was a $40 late fee on a VHS of Apollo 13.
It wasn't Rochelle, an erotic Apollo journey 13. From Milan to Minsk?
What the hell are you talking
Doesn't
about,
Doesn't anybody
David?
Watch Seinfeld?
No.
Oh,
no. Okay.
Kirby Enthusiasm.
We have three more questions. Number 8. This one's simple. Queen Elizabeth II is a trained mechanic.
We have an Englishman in
no,
the
No, it's true. She did it during the World War II.
Exactly.
Correct.
Yeah. What? Yes.
No, wait, she said.
Yeah. I have no idea.
She did it during
World
War
II. He doesn't even know who that is.
New phone. Who dis?
Let's be controversial. How do you feel about the Queen?
Lost my phone. Who is this?
No comment.
All right. Question number 9. An estimated 1,000 dogs in the U.S. have been named primary beneficiary in their owners' wills.
Absolutely.
True. True. Absolutely true.
I would say more.
Yeah. You're
false.
Spot on.
Okay.
Oh. How many?
You said an estimated
I said an estimated 1,000.
Oh. It's got to be over a million.
1.1
10,000.
It's over a million. Yeah.
It's 1 billion.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing.
That's crazy.
I mean, people are marrying themselves now, so nothing's crazy.
Think about all the crazy cat ladies and dog ladies and single people who have animals and don't have families.
Okay, guys, here's what you should do. Donate it to Heritage Radio Network because we will put it to good use. Your dog
wandering
loves listening to the radio.
We'll take in the dog.
Just so we need
HeritageRadioNetwork.org, hit the beating heart on the right-hand corner of your screen, and donate your entire nest egg rather than leave it to your dog.
The nice word for this is planned giving. Thank you all.
That is nice.
Thank you, Hannah.
That was planning. The executive director speaking.
This has been the best plug for donations I've ever heard.
And I get
dogs out of it. So everybody wins. Everybody
we'll also
wins.
Also take your dogs happily. We have a dog-friendly office. It's more than dog-friendly.
It's
like
dog-friendly,
excessively
if you ask
friendly.
Me.
Yes.
I'd say it's dog-dominated.
We've been letting them walk all over us for too long.
All right, last question. The Haas avocado is named after Rudolph Haas, a California postman who patented the Haas avocado in 1935.
So much detail.
True.
True.
It is true.
Yes.
The HQ question.
Oh.
That's amazing.
All right, that's our show. That's our trivia. That's our show. Yay. We get to drink amazing cocktails, talk about things that matter.
Thanks for having us.
Love it.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you so much, ladies.
Thanks to Esther. Thanks to Julian, Darren, and Roxanne. Thanks to Hannah, and thanks to Sarah, and David, and Katie.
Thank you, Kat.
All right, that's our show. We'll be next week. We have a very special show. We're going to have guest hosts.
No, that's not true. You're still hosting.
What? That's right.
We'll
I will be hosting. I might sound a little different. But tune in next week. We're going to have a very special guest from the Oxford Food Symposium. Yes. All right. We'll see you next week.
Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
HRN Happy Hour is powered by Simplecast.
Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.